Well, good afternoon, everyone. I hope everyone has filled their stomachs with good food, had an extra coffee to keep that energy going, because this is the grand finale. If we had fireworks and confetti, we would put it behind us. My name is Heather Conley. I'm a senior fellow and director of the Europe program here at CSIS. And Janusz and I, our offices are right beside each other, and we tend to have a very wide and deep view of Europe, and our collaboration is terrific, and I'm delighted, thank you, Janusz, for including me in this conversation. And nothing could give me greater pleasure than to be able to introduce a fantastic Foreign Service officer whom I think has the best job at the State Department. And I speak about that because that used to be my old job. But Masha has expanded her empire. She now includes not only the 15 countries of the Nordic, Baltic, and Central Europe, but includes Austria, Germany, and Switzerland, if I have that correct. No longer Germany. Oh, Liechtenstein. Liechtenstein. Okay, we're good. We don't. In fact, we have a wonderful program with the Liechtenstein Embassy here, so fantastic. Masha became Deputy Assistant Secretary in June of this year after a fantastic tour. This is almost a separate seminar on her previous tours as U.S. Ambassador to Armenia, U.S. Ambassador to Kyrgyzstan, the Kyrgyz Republic, and has served in a variety of posts, Moscow, London, Ottawa, Mogadishu. She has served as senior advisor to the Undersecretary for Political Affairs. So needless to say, the richness of her knowledge and substance is terrific. And we're looking forward to hearing your thoughts on Central Europe and the transatlantic links with Central Europe. We're going to be very mindful of time, and we want to be respectful both of your time at the end of a Friday, TGIF, and we know that Masha Janusz has to depart a little after 2, and we need to get her back to the State Department to get back to work. So we will have Masha give a presentation and then open the floor for some good Q&A. And again, we thank you, and Deputy Assistant Secretary Jovanovic, the floor is yours. Welcome to CSIS.
Thank you very much for that really generous introduction. And and I really want to thank all of you for being here today, especially on a Friday afternoon. It's really an honor for me to be here with you to discuss U.S. relations with the Central European states. And I know that there are folks here from those countries as well as from the embassies. And I'd just like to say the United States really honors the nations of Central Europe for what they've achieved over the past 2 decades as well as their very rich histories, and values Central Europe as a partner as we move into the future. Over the past 20 years, our partnership with Central Europe has demonstrated great growth. And for me, coming relatively new to the region, it's really been remarkable to see how we partner with Central Europe today. In the immediate years following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, we cooperated together on internal issues, establishing democratic institutions, creating successful free market economies, and achieving membership in NATO and the European Union. These obviously are the accomplishments of the countries themselves. We like to think that we played a supporting role, and we're proud of that supporting role. Now, we focus together very much on addressing global challenges in places as diverse as Cuba, Libya, and Afghanistan. And I fully expect that this evolution will continue as we work together to address the global challenges of this new century, some of which, you know, are immediately apparent to all of us as we look at what is going on in the world, others that will develop over the decades. We work together because of our shared interests and also because of our shared values. The nations of Central Europe embody the ideals of democracy and freedom that are so much a part of America's identity as well. The bonds of culture and history are strong across the Atlantic, built by the generations of European immigrants who enriched the United States as this nation grew. And we returned that favor as some of the children and grandchildren returned to Central Europe to help rebuild following the collapse of communism. Especially since the Central European nations began joining NATO, starting in 1999 with Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, our security cooperation has grown and intensified. The nations of Central Europe are among the top contributors to the missions in Afghanistan and Kosovo. Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic all lead provincial reconstruction teams in Afghanistan, while Romanian troops control the Kabul airport and patrol the crucial Kabul-Kandahar highway. Bulgaria is moving forward to modernize and transform its land forces to fulfill NATO's need for capabilities and is planning to create an expeditionary force of two deployable brigades with three battalion battle groups each. Poland and Romania are playing key roles in our new missile defense design. Just last month, the U.S. and Romania signed the U.S.-Romanian Ballistic Missile Defense Agreement. Once ratified, it will allow the United States to build, maintain, and operate the land-based BMD site in Romania. And in 2009, Poland agreed to host the interceptor site. And with the Polish ratification process recently completed, this agreement has now entered into force. Our new missile defense architecture in Europe will provide stronger, smarter, and swifter defenses of American forces and America's allies, as President Obama has said. The NATO summit in Chicago next May is an opportunity for allies and for partners to continue the critical efforts to meet 21st century challenges, especially during these times of significant pressure on defense spending. The fiscal environment means that the United States, and in fact every nation in NATO, will depend on each other even more to share the burdens of protecting our common interests. Emerging and non-traditional threats such as cyber attacks, terrorism, transnational crime, and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction lead to new areas of cooperation, innovation, and an expanded role for niche capabilities. We must therefore remain committed, capable, and connected to ensure an adequate response to counter potential challenges. Security cooperation is not an option, it's a necessity. Energy security and diversification is a growing element in our dialogue with Central European partners. We're looking for ways to advance the Global Shale Gas Initiative aimed at helping partner countries better understand and facilitate development of this new method of producing natural gas. While shale gas development is in its infancy and will likely not have a major impact on the European market for a number of years, it does have the potential to help offset declining indigenous production, reducing import dependence. U.S. companies currently are exploring investment opportunities in Central Europe. For example, in Poland, a U.S. energy company now has a total stake of 1 million acres for shale gas exploration, with another 1.5 million acres in Romania. Bulgaria also has granted an exploration permit for a prospective shale gas block of more than 1 million acres, for a combined total of around 4 million acres in the countries. We're also pursuing cooperation in the field of nuclear energy. As President Obama said in Prague in April 2009, we must harness the power of nuclear energy on behalf of our efforts to combat climate change and to advance peace and opportunity for all people. Nuclear energy can contribute substantially to climate change mitigation, economic growth, energy security, and national security. Each year, the United States identifies the top five markets for nuclear energy. The Czech Republic was identified as a top potential market with a 2011 tender expected for five new reactors, estimated to be worth $27.5 billion. Of course, not a secret to this audience or probably any other audience, we're hoping that a U.S. company will be awarded that tender, and that could have as much as $12.5 billion in U.S. export content and could trigger a cascade of commercial successes throughout Central Europe. In Poland, a similarly anticipated tender for 2011 could be worth up to $21 billion, with an estimated $4.6 billion in U.S. export potential. In December 2010, the U.S. and the Czech Republic launched an economic and commercial dialogue, signed a joint declaration on commercial cooperation in the civil nuclear field, and began discussions on collaboration on nuclear research and development. One result of this was the regional nuclear safety workshop that was just held in Prague at the beginning of the month. The information exchange workshop provided an opportunity for invited countries to share technical information on trends and advances in nuclear safety management practices, safety assessment and verification methods, reactor and plant life extension research and development requirements, and activities for enhancing the safe operation of the current fleet of nuclear power plants in the expected global expansion of nuclear power. An area where we've seen the most dynamic change in our relationship is in the growth of Central European economies. And I'll start this section by looking back a little bit. In 1989, the U.S. established enterprise funds as non-political, not-for-profit U.S. corporations in the post-communist region. And their primary purpose was to promote private sector development, and today we can really look back on many success stories. Most of these funds earned proceeds from their investments and have since transferred these assets to legacy foundations, which use them to further promote private sector development. Bulgaria's fund liquidation value was about $450 million, which was the largest of any of the funds, and Poland came in second at $383 million. The funds have really left a lasting legacy in Eastern Europe, providing over $1.2 billion to endow 8 legacy foundations, which continue to strengthen civil society, democracy, and education. For example, the Polish American Freedom Foundation supports initiatives of Polish non-governmental organizations involved in sharing Poland's experience in various aspects of transformation and the development of cooperation with partners in Eastern Europe, the South Caucasus, and Central Asia. The program includes grant competitions, training opportunities, and study visits to Poland. And one of the more recent projects that they've been involved in is Polish students to intern at American companies. And that's sort of a three-way venture between the American Embassy in Warsaw, the foundation itself, and then private American companies. And it's been very, very successful. The U.S. strongly supports economic development through fostering innovation and entrepreneurship. In Sofia, we support the America for Bulgaria Foundation Summer Entrepreneurship Program and Junior Achievement Bulgaria's Smart Start Conference. These programs are helping the younger generation of Bulgarians learn entrepreneurship and leadership skills, as well as social responsibility. In another positive development, NASA just awarded the biggest aviation prize ever to a Slovenian company for development of the most energy-efficient aircraft. And the Slovenian owners have donated $100,000 of their prize money to a fund financing yet another and new competition to help develop a supersonic electronic plane. I mean, it's just a great example of paying it forward. Finally, and perhaps firstly, the greatest area for growth in our cooperation with Central Europe is through the joint promotion of democracy. In June, when Secretary Clinton was in Hungary, she said that democracy is struggling to be born around the world today. The nations of Central and Eastern Europe have so much to share from their own struggles and triumphs. And we believe Europe's newly successful nations can help other countries achieve similar progress. And in fact, that's exactly what they're doing. Poland has been a leader in democracy promotion, both in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East and North Africa, by promoting civil society in Belarus and supporting transition in Libya. And I was reading yesterday an article that during the recent Polish elections, there were a group from Northern Africa, from I think Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, watching how elections were held in Poland. And I think that's just another great example of what the Central European countries are able to share with countries that are in the midst of their transitions now. Poland is also co-chairing, along with the United States, the Moldova Task Force of the Democracy Partnership Challenge, designed to support emerging democracies undergoing promising transitions. Slovakia is also working internationally with NGOs. They're working on media monitoring to the promotion of civic activism to share Slovakia's experience with transition. And they, too, are co-chairing one of the Democracy Partnership Challenge task forces, this one focused on Tunisia. Similar efforts continue to be launched throughout the region. For example, the Bulgarian foreign minister hosted a conference on the lessons the Middle East and North Africa can learn from Central and Eastern European transitions to democracy. That was a conference that was in June, I believe, and UN Security General Ban Ki-moon and our very own Ambassador William Taylor, who's the newly appointed coordinator for Mideast transitions, also participated in that important conference. And in Budapest, as you know, I think probably most of you know, the secretary as well as former Secretary Rice and many others recently helped inaugurate the launch of the Tom Lantos Institute, which focuses, of course, on Central and Eastern Europe, the Western Balkans, and other areas, again, to advance the democratization processes and to strengthen basic human rights, especially focused on Roma issues, as well as other fundamental freedoms. This fall, President Obama, last fall, he continued it this fall, President Obama launched a major new initiative to support democracy and good governance, the Open Government Partnership Initiative, and there was a major conference at the UN with the countries that actually joined over the last year, and among them, of course, are many from Central Europe. And this multilateral initiative seeks to secure concrete commitments from governments to promote transparency, empower citizens, fight corruption, and harness new technologies to strengthen governance. There will be a follow-up conference in December, and then in the February-March timeframe, there will be another very high-level meeting to see how the countries are moving forward and what sorts of tasks they are taking on. So I think we have a lot of hopes for this initiatives. We also, you know, as we look at our relationships, I think sometimes the most important element of any bilateral relationship is actually the people-to-people exchanges, the things that all of you are doing as you interact with colleagues from Central Europe and from other countries. And, of course, with all of the changes over the last two decades, with countries becoming more open and more prosperous, you've got thousands of students and others coming from Central Europe under their own steam, sponsoring themselves. And I think that when people come to the United States to visit, to travel, to study, I think sometimes that is the most important thing in creating relationships between countries. And, of course, we go to these countries ourselves. And when I say we, I mean we as private individuals, and continue to build those really important bonds. The U.S., though, because we think that these kinds of bonds are so important, we do continue to sponsor both traditional and non-traditional government programs to encourage exchanges. And because we just think that sharing with one another, those bonds of friendship become much tighter and enable us to do so much more, whether it's on the economy, whether it's on political issues, whether it's on security. Recently, the U.S. created the Young Leaders Dialogue with America, and this program provides strategic opportunities among emerging leaders from Central Europe and their U.S. counterparts on issues of mutual interest. There's a dialogue with leaders from about 12 Central European and Baltic countries, with leaders from all over the United States. And they focused on three themes: new challenges in transatlantic security, climate change and environmental issues, and tolerance and diversity. The participants have met several times, and their discussions have translated into real actions. For example, they're working on one joint project that will help determine how social media can be used in international law enforcement or intelligence investigations. Another one created created internships for young Hungarians to come to Washington and to learn about how Washington-based NGOs work and to motivate them for public service. And so perhaps some of you all are participating in that particular project. We in the U.S. government are very interested in partnering not only with today's leadership in these countries, but also with tomorrow's, and we hope that this is one of the ways that we can do this. In closing, what I'd like to know is that we in the U.S. government, we don't think that we've got all the answers, and certainly in a room like this, I wouldn't even try to claim that, since many of you have spent your professional lives working on these issues and thinking about these issues. We also don't have all of the resources to solve the world's problems. We're constantly trying to find new ways and avenues for cooperation in conjunction with our Central European allies, and we welcome your thoughts. And I know that there, over the years, there's been a vigorous discussion with many of you on how to move issues forward, on how we can better engage. And as I'm starting this new job, I'm looking forward to engaging in that discussion with you, because I think many of you have some of the best ideas. I also want to say that we understand that the transitions in Central Europe aren't complete. Just as in the U.S., you know, we are continuing to strive for our more perfect union, as our founding fathers said. In Central Europe, it's also a transition. The countries of Central Europe are continuing to strengthen their democracies and working on how to strengthen their economies and their security as well. And this is something that we understand all too well, not only because we partner with these countries, but also because we in the United States are experiencing many of the same challenges and are working through some of those challenges as well. But that doesn't mean that we can't cooperate together on a wide range of issues. We believe that that kind of collaboration is just invaluable to the United States, and we think it brings value to the nations of Central Europe as well. And as we continue our journey into the 21st century, we are all aware of how the global context has changed over the last 20-plus years, and as part of that evolution, the way we have worked together has also naturally changed and matured. Today, much of Central Europe has transitioned from receiving assistance to providing assistance, from establishing democracy within its borders to promoting democracy abroad, and from developing military capabilities to deploying them. We in the U.S. are at a critical juncture when we have shifted from mentoring some of these states to asking Central European countries to mentor others. Likewise, our security relationships have moved from strictly helping nations in Central Europe to improve capabilities and interoperability to increasingly seeing our Central European partners, the Central European nations partner with us, contributing to NATO and UN operations worldwide. And our allies have proved to be reliable, competent partners in fostering security and stability across the globe. And again, I would say, obviously, this benefits the United States. I think it benefits all of the countries in the region and around the world. In my first few months in this job, I've had the pleasure of speaking with some of you, not with all of you, but hopefully I'll get to know more of you as I spend more time in this job. And a number of people have shared with me the view that the U.S. is focusing on other regions and challenges around the world to the detriment of our engagement with Europe. And I know that that's a familiar argument to many in the room. And so I'd like to share with you something that Phil Gordon, Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs, Phil Gordon said in Budapest earlier this year. He said, you know, this doesn't come at the expense of the relationship with Europe, but in fact makes the relationship with Europe all the more important. It's precisely because we are faced with such tremendous challenges around the world and with the knowledge that we in the United States can't deal with all of these challenges alone that we need strong partners. We need partners who are democratic and stable and see the world like we do and are militarily capable. And where do you think we find them? We find them in Europe. Perhaps this best sums up the title of today's session, which is Transatlanticism in Transition. We're moving from one kind of relationship to another, one in which we work together on shared challenges beyond Europe's borders. It doesn't mean that we don't also work on kind of European qua European issues, and in fact, we have, you know, many areas where we're working with countries on particular issues. But we also work on the broader challenges together, and that is just vitally important in an era of increasing challenges. The new century brought with it not only new international challenges and new global issues, but also new opportunities for us to meet those challenges side by side as we move forward together in the areas of security, economic development, and democracy, as allies, as partners, and as friends. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for those clear and concise remarks. My watch says we have about 15 minutes, and I know I've got about two questions that I'm going to seize the moderator's prerogative and throw out. But what I thought, just to compress time, if we could bundle the questions, and then I'll turn to you for final comments to both reflect on those questions. If you'll please we have a microphone available. If you could please tell us your name and your affiliation, and as we always like to say, keep those questions short and concise and the comments very much to the point. While I have the prerogative, two questions, and focusing on the theme of transitions and your point on the incomplete transitions of Central Europe. I continue to grow increasingly concerned about Hungary and its transition, and in fact, the fear of its transition rolling back. And Secretary Clinton's visit this summer, I think, sent a very important message. And as we read our Washington Post today, we realize that things are not well within the U.S.-Hungarian dynamic, potentially, at least with our ambassador. If you could shed some light on how the administration is looking at these challenges and dealing with this transition, that would be greatly appreciated. And then the second transition of transatlanticism and transition, I spend a great deal of my time, I think I could rename my program the Director of European Economics. We focus on the sovereign debt crisis and the implications, the political, military, economic implications. Your list, you presented a strong list of security issues, energy, nuclear, obviously the economic on U.S. commercial benefits. How are we changing the dynamic of our relationship that understands and appreciates the implications of this unfolding, some would argue, unraveling economic crisis in Europe? And how does that affect your agenda? Okay, that's me. I'll stop. I know we have a question in the back. The gentleman in the purple shirt, please.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. You had mentioned various efforts to get more transparency and people working together in democracies, and I wonder to what extent you've been able to use the internet in this and get participation from people in the other countries and show it to everybody.
Yes, good afternoon. Paul Marino. I represent a handful of congressional campaigns that are preparing for 2012. And so my question deals with EU-American policy in that, do you think the American people are satisfied with the return on the investment that comes with the financial resources and the military resources we've invested into the Atlantic Alliance? And corollary to that, are there some things that we should bring in from the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that are going on there in the Pacific region into the Atlantic system? For example, the railroad projects, the Siberian development projects, or particularly the nuclear power projects.
I have to learn how to use these things. Well, if I may just take a moment as being perhaps the devil's advocate. You brought up for Madame Yovanovitch, you brought up the question of helping to work with the shale gas and oil shale, but help get off the dependence on Russia and perhaps certain other unfriendly sources. But at the same time, you're working with climate change, and still the product of gas or oil from shale that you use for fuel is a fossil fuel and will contribute greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide and perhaps certain other unburned hydrocarbons to the atmosphere, maybe to a lesser degree, but still to some extent. I just want to ask how does, and while at the same time we're doing this here, and you have environmental advocacy groups, you know, threatening to sue to stop the project, say in New York and Pennsylvania, how do we resolve this dichotomy?
Zori Samaric, Defense Counselor at the Embassy of Montenegro. I know that the Western Balkans is not the focus of your responsibilities, but would you be so kind to reflect a little bit within the transatlanticism in transition, the place of the Western Balkans, particularly having in mind those good news that just came from Brussels, Montenegro being actually delivered a positive progress report, and waiting for opening a accession process with European Union and Serbia becoming a candidate country, most probably in December. Thank you very much.
Well, that was a wonderful tour of the region and some very interesting questions, and I will turn the floor to you for final reflections on those questions and comments.
Because I can't work this either.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Again, thank you for all of those questions. I'll just pretty much take them in order, although I'll group the two questions that focused on Hungary together. In terms of looking at Hungary or looking frankly at any other country in the world, I mean clearly. One of the bases of our relationships with Hungary is the shared interests that we've got with Hungary and also the shared values. We both belong to many of the same international organizations, NATO, the UN, the OSCE, and so forth. And so that's really the basis for a really important partnership relationship. When the secretary was in Budapest, one of the things that she noted is that this is a thriving democracy. The new government won an overwhelming mandate, and it was a mandate for change. And sometimes that happens in countries. What's important is that change continue to reflect the important democratic values that I think are critical to the Hungarian people, and it's important that as that change takes place that the government consults widely and broadly. We've seen that obviously the Constitution was put forward relatively quickly after the government took power, and as a result of that constitution, a number of cardinal laws need to be issued by the end of December, and obviously that's a very, very tight time frame for really important laws on things like judiciary, religion, the courts, the press, etc., and those are important laws. And we encourage the Hungarian government to consult not only with its own people but also with experts like ODIHR, like the Venice Commission on the various laws to ensure that as they are promulgating these laws that they don't have unintended effects. Because when you're drafting so quickly and over such a broad range of issues, perhaps there can be unintended consequences. We've seen with the media law and now with the religion law that the Hungarian government, in response, I think, some of the concerns that have been expressed by experts and also by those some in Hungary, they have reviewed the laws. I mean, the media law has been changed, and I understand that the religion law is also there are going to be amendments to the religion law as well, and so that's I think a very positive development. You had asked Anna about the year of Central Europe, I believe you called it. with the chairmanship of the EU. The Hungary's focus was on the Roma, and the Roma, Hungary was successful in getting the EU to decide that there would be Roma action plans that every country would then draft. And as we've seen with some of the developments that have more recent developments with demonstrations and really worrisome events in both Bulgaria and Romania, I think that it's a really welcome development to focus each of the countries on establishing action plans. And I think they're going to be coming down in the next several months, and I think that's a really good thing. The plans obviously have to be carefully established, but even more important will be how they're implemented. And so that's going to be critical. The other area that I think the Hungarian government really focused on in its presidency was the Croatian accession, and obviously that was a milestone, and kind of leads me to your question in terms of how we see the Balkans. I mean, we want to see the Balkans fully integrated into the rest of Europe, whether it's on the economic level, whether it's on a political level or security, because clearly there continue to be issues, and we want to see that integration, which would be good for the individual countries as well as Europe as a whole. In terms of the sovereign debt issue that you raised. The, clearly we are in very challenging times, and that's probably an understatement that we're in yeah, exactly. But this is obviously the economic crisis is a really important issue, and it is something that I think has not only seized the imagination of the people of all of the countries, but also the leadership of the countries, and we're. I don't want to underestimate the challenges, but I think we're fully confident that the European nations and the U.S., to the extent that it's involved, are capable of dealing with this challenge. It's going to be hard, but I think it's necessary. I mean, we just have to do it. You had also asked what is the effect going to be on bilateral and multilateral relations. It's hard to know, but at the end of the day, what doesn't kill us makes us strong, and I think that as we work through some of these issues, we will have to figure out how to. And I hate to fall back on cliches, but it's true. How do you work smarter? How do you work harder? How do we do more for the time being with less? I don't think it's always going to be less. But how do we figure that out? And I think that when we look around the world, that's what we're doing. And there's been a lot of emphasis recently on private-public partnerships. And I know that many of you, through your organizations, are some of those partners. We also obviously engage with companies as well. I think that companies, NGOs, individuals increasingly will play a big role as we look around at what those challenges are. You had mentioned the internet, and I think certainly if we didn't know it before, Steve Jobs unfortunately passed away, we certainly know it now in terms of what one individual can do and how he can so shape our lives, all of our lives. And I think I think that's what we're going to see more of, even as the role of government continues. It's just that 50 years ago, governments had certain roles. I think now NGOs have a more prominent role. It doesn't diminish the role of government, but we partner with NGOs, we partner with think tanks, we partner with corporations, because we all see it in our interests to work on particular projects, whether it is on social media, and we've seen a lot of those kinds of partnerships, whether it's on humanitarian kinds of projects, whether it's even on democracy projects. And so I think that's been a really interesting development over the last 20 or so years, and I think we're going to be seeing more of that. There was also a question, I think, about the visa regimes. This is obviously an issue that is of great interest in the region. And when President Obama was in Warsaw, he addressed it directly and said that, you know, he was interested in seeing, you know, where we could go on this issue. Secretary Clinton also recently mentioned this when the Romanian president was in town in September. So I think this is an area that we are focused on because we... I think sometimes people think that the visa regime is in place to keep people out of America. It's not. We are trying to facilitate travel to the United States. We want people to come to the United States to travel, to study, and to kind of create that bond between our countries. So we want to see what we can do in terms of the visa regimes for Central European countries as well. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization? I think you had asked about that. I have to say I'm not completely familiar with everything that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization does, but you know, I mean, if you could share more with me about that at a later time, you know, perhaps I could take a look at that. I think that was it.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay.
Well, thank you all so much. I think we 5 minutes straight into past 2 o'clock, but please join me in thanking Deputy Assistant Secretary Yanovich for being with us today. Thank you so much.